Okay, we can get started now. All right, I am Craig Branch and director of the Apologetics Resource Center, and we're headquartered in Birmingham, Alabama. I encourage you to pick up a copy of our newsletter on our table over here, and it gets a free subscription. It's kind of a cultural apologetics and practical apologetics input to you every other month or so. And we also have a journal that's coming out, and that's also free if you'd like to sign up on our sign-up sheet for that. We'll be glad to start sending you that as well. Now, the topic of this session could be many titles. I've titled after the name of the book that I've written with John Ankerberg and Weldon, Public Schools, The Sorcerer's New Apprentice. It's actually a reprint of the earlier edition called Thieves of Innocence. I changed the name on the reprint because not many people understood what Thieves of Innocence was. It's a real cute, catchy title, but it didn't tell anybody anything as far as which category it was in. But I wanted to name it, What Did Your Child Learn in School Today? Which would be a provocative kind of a title. But this is what the subject's about. It's about the problematic philosophy, certain problematic philosophies which have made its way into curricula and certain programs in public, mainly public, and some private schools in the United States and our Western culture. Let's begin with prayer before we start. Father, again, we don't treat any this time as a formality, but we really are bowing before you because we are seeking your spirit, your face, to teach us, to guide us, to equip us to be better parents, to be more truly salt and light where you've called us to be. Help us to be redemptive change agents in a dying culture as we engage philosophies, as we engage people, and use this time for the furtherance of your kingdom in our lives and around us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. My mic, this is just recording. I'll try to speak up. In Colossians chapter 2, verse 8, Paul's instruction, God's instruction through Paul to the church is, see to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. This was a specific passage dealing with a kind of a Gnostic philosophy that it began to permeate its way into the church, but the principle is still an internal principle for all of us to any philosophy that we are to be on guard against that seeps in to take us captive. And, of course, the contrast here in this passage is rather than according to Christ, because it goes on and says, for in him, for in Christ, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. That's our source of reference of truth. Our only source of truth that we can know truly is that which is revealed from God. And Christ, of course, is the Word of God made flesh and dwelling among us. Now, another passage, of course, to keep in mind that's relevant to this is in Romans 12, 2. Do not be conformed any longer to the world. In other words, let the world press you into its mold. But instead, in contrast, be transformed by the renewing of your mind that you may know what the will of God is. Again, the issue of truth, understanding in contrast to autonomous human wisdom as opposed to God's wisdom. Now, what does that have to do with our subject at hand? I think you'll see in just a moment. Read to you a portion from the introduction to our book. It says that this book takes a critical look at certain trends in education as they relate to particular religious or psychological, moral, or scientific issues. Our basic concern is to evaluate two key trends that may be termed transpersonal, which means beyond the person, and humanistic approaches to education. The transpersonal method can also be known as New Age education, as it employs various Eastern and occult beliefs and techniques to allegedly help children develop their, quote, full potential. The humanistic trend incorporates a secular and/or psychological approach which stresses, one, values clarification or allegedly moral neutral approach towards helping children develop their own values independently and autonomously, two, the importance of fostering a child's self-esteem, three, the use of various psychotherapeutic techniques, such as those incorporated in what's called transpersonal or affective education. We'll hear that term more in just a moment. Or even meditation slash hypnotic hypnosis methodology. But the fact that transpersonal education is religious and humanistic education is secular does not mean that these two approaches operate independently of one another. What we find is a significant degree of overlap and interaction, so that transpersonal and humanistic approaches are often used together. The question is whether or not either approach is in the best interest of our children. And I'll go even further than that, whether or not they are legal, even legal, to be used in the public school system. Let me kind of give you the picture here. First of all, we have to look at our culture. What gave birth to all this philosophy? And that's a long story, of course. We've heard a lot of it already in this conference about the transition from a Judeo-Christian ethos shaping our culture to a modernist ethos, empiricism, rationalistic ethos, that the center of the universe was man. Man could determine through science, technology, and empirical thought, rationalism, he could solve the problems, to a postmodern culture. And we can't really say that a culture has all of one thing, because there's a mixture. We see trends happening. And, you know, back in the 60s was a kind of a watershed time when all traditional values and authority were being questioned. The Vietnam War helped precipitate that. This disillusionment with our culture and the pieces of people in authority, and a lot of factors, of course, entered into that as well. The media and communication avenues, a lot of things entered into all that and precipitated that. But what we have is we had the people in the 60s are now grown up. And they have positions of influence. And some of the philosophies they began to gravitate towards and adopt, and that some of the Eastern mysticism and the humanistic values began to certainly continue to affect the way they think and do, and their values, their goals, their missionary zeal, in a sense of trying to change the world, has not subsided. And some of these people are in positions of influence, and especially in the educational field. Now, what precipitated some of the application to this? Well, I mentioned that American schools are in danger of shipwreck as it reflects where our culture is, and in many ways. Predictably, because of humanism, secular humanism, materialism, naturalism, all these factors that made up the modernistic viewpoint of the world, did not work in its application in our culture. And as a result, we see these social indicators sharply escalating, the social ill indicators have sharply risen. William Bennett pointed out in a book he's written a few years ago, he says, between 1960 and 1990, violent crime increased 560%. Illegitimate births increased by 400%. Divorce rates quadrupled. The number of children living in single-parent homes tripled. Teenage suicide increased by 200%. There's been a drop of 80 points in the average SAT scores. Between 1972 and 1990, teenage pregnancies climbed from 49.4% to 99.2% per thousand girls. Not in percent, 49.4 to 99.2 per thousand girls. Child abuse escalated from 101 to 420 per thousand in reported cases from 1976 to 1991. Alcohol and drug use was unacceptably high, with alcohol average usage averaging around 90% for high school students since 1975. 1993, U.S. Department of Education survey indicated that two-thirds of our high school students cannot read at their own grade level. Furthermore, 9.3 million Americans are functionally illiterate. Now, this is kind of the sixth state of our culture. Now, you have to understand, school teachers are usually in the profession, by and large, because they care about children. And they really do care. And educators, by and large, care about children. They have idealistic, optimistic expectations. And that's why they're in their profession. And what happens is that the kids that are coming out of single-parent homes, not all single-parent homes are bad, but there's obviously more pressures, more problems in that area, from abuse-type situations and lack of authority and rebellion against authority and all these things. They're coming to school, and they're bringing these residual problems with them. And they have behavioral problems and academic problems. So who's going to fix it? The educators are going to fix it. And again, idealistically, and they're looking around for solutions. And where do you look for the solutions of these problems? What field, what scientific field do you look for solving behavioral problems and increasing academic performance? Educational psychology. And they begin to look to some of the leaders in that field, in the educational field, Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow, leading proponents. Now, how many people have ever taken psychology before? Ever heard those names? They're they're preeminent in that field. And so their approach of client-centered, non-directive therapy and their idea of the hierarchical needs, you've seen that in the hierarchical needs pyramid, of self-actualization began to be the goal of educators in implementing these types of strategies into the curriculum and not in all education, but certain segments of it. Well, I became aware of this in my normal study of the New Age movement over the years, many years ago, back in the 80s. And ironically, here we are in Denver, Colorado, and what really caught my eye, I would read books like from Russ Chandler, his book, Understanding the New Age Movement, the religion writer for the Los Angeles Times, who wrote a book years ago. And he was reporting on a chapter on education about how this kooky stuff was happening in the public schools in California. Now, here I'm in Alabama, you know, the Bible Belt, and I'm thinking, yep, California, yeah. That's the land of the flakes and the nuts over there, and you can expect that to happen over there. But here in Alabama, it'd be 20 years. You know, we're insulated from all that. I know what some of y'all are thinking about Alabama, but we're actually I'm from Virginia, so we're pretty arrogant about our aristocracy status of Virginia too. But anyway, I've been living in Alabama a long time. But anyway, I said never get here. It'd be a long time before it gets here. Then someone sent to me a copy of the New York Times Magazine of May 1st, 1988. I still remember it. On the front cover, maybe y'all remember this if y'all are long-time residents here. On the front cover, there's a woman in a pyramid structure in a lotus position meditating. And the title of the magazine front cover story was Colorado's Thriving Cults. And in there, there was a wonderful article written by a secular writer, a very good, balanced, informative article about the permeation of the New Age philosophy in Colorado and its various aspects. It even talked about New Age real estate agents, how they would come to various homes and cleanse the space to make it compatible in harmony with your energy fields and stuff like this. And I was reading through this, and golly, then I saw a picture. This is about an 8-page article, a long article. Inside, there was a picture of a color picture, 3/4 across both pages, had children lying down. Looks like they were taking a nap. This is what it said. Y'all can read that. Can you read that in the back there? Eric, can you read that? It says, below in Boulder, of course, Boulder, you know. In Boulder, second and third graders listen quietly while a teacher leads a visualization. Vocal parents groups have protested the encroachment of New Age practices in school curricula. Well, I said, isn't that interesting? Then I read in the main text of the article, meditational techniques have become common fare in the state's public and private schools. I read that and I said, how can that be? That's impossible. The Supreme Court has wrongly interpreted the Establishment Clause, but they've interpreted it by saying there can be no prayer in the public schools. Now, how in the world can they get away with this? Because this is Eastern prayer. How do they get away with it? And I said, oh yeah, because everybody in the West is so oriented to Western religious belief systems. This is a new concept to grapple with. They haven't really been tested and refined and defined very well. So anyway, I said, well, that's something else. Well, there's another paragraph in here that I think really encapsulates this entire story of what's happening in our schools across the country. Many Colorado schools, and you can substitute schools around the country, utilize practices adapted from Eastern meditation under the rubric of centering, stress reduction, or guided visualization, usually with the aim of enhancing a student's self-esteem and creativity, or presenting an alternative to alcohol and drugs. Now, what I began to find as I began to get into the research of this and documentation of this is these kinds of philosophies, which we'll again describe in just a moment, tended to come in through guidance counseling curriculum, student self-esteem, because that became the end-all answer for the problems of students. Give them a better self-esteem and they'll do better. You know, artificially induce this self-esteem by telling them how great they are, no matter how their performance is. They're wonderful, 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 and they'll do better because they'll be inspired. And we found that through guidance counseling, through gifted and talented courses, increasing creativity, through drug resistance programs, and through drug and alcohol programs, and also teenage sex seminars on, what do you call it, the teenage prevention, sex prevention thing. So we have, these are the kinds of ways these programs began to enter into the curriculum through these avenues. Well, then I said, well, Denver, Boulder, John Denver, you know, Rocky Mountain High, yeah, kind of, California, Colorado. It'll be another still 20 years before we get to Alabama. That was in May 1988. In September of 1988, somebody brought to me a course description of some programs in the Birmingham City Schools. This was the education. This was the program of, I forgot what the official name of it is, but it was the community school program where you could take courses in the evening, or adults could take them, kids could take, anybody can take them. On Saturdays, it's community edge. I don't know if y'all have that here, but here I was. This is sponsored and funded by the Board of Education, so it still falls under that category. Look at some of these classes. A class on spirit journeying. Psychic development and awareness is available to us all. Join Birmingham Psychic, LaRue Jolly. Astral travel, the ways we can benefit from accessing information and teaching skills from the outer plane. We have shiatsu. We have astrology. We have an evening with Pros and Serena, trans-channelers. Down here at the bottom, we have the healing energy patterns and use of crystals. How crystals can bring physical and spiritual healing patterns to your body. Tai Chi was another, or Tai Chi, however you want to pronounce that, is another part of the curriculum. And I'm thinking, what? Birmingham, Alabama? This is unheard of. It would have something like this. So I called up the director of the community school program, and I said, my name's Craig Branch, and I saw this curriculum. Let me ask you a question. Do y'all have any policies regulating religion in the public schools? And she said, well, yes. School curriculum is not allowed to promote the ideology or practice of a religion. I said, have you ever heard of Hinduism, Buddhism, witchcraft, the occult, New Age movement? Have you ever heard of those terms? She says, well, yeah, they're religions. I said, do you not realize, and I said, this course curriculum is promoting the ideology and practices of those religions? And she says something very interesting. She says, well, Mr. Branch, yours is the first complaint we've heard about this. And in 2 years, she said. I said, you're kidding. Which told me something. It told me something about the ignorance or the apathy of the Christian community, or both. Well, then I called up the president of the Board of Education for the Birmingham City Schools, who happened to be a committed Christian, evangelical Christian. And I started reading this course curriculum description over the telephone, and the woman audibly gasped on the telephone, which told me something else. In a bureaucracy, sometimes the right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. And so I explained, I shared that with her, and immediately she called and got the courses canceled. That told me something else. That one Christian, or actually two Christians, can make a difference. It makes a difference that you as Christians start taking leadership responsibility, not retreating from the culture, but get elected to school boards. Get elected to these things so you can have positions of influence. And it takes another Christian to be informed enough to bring the issues up. So those are important lessons to learn. Now, I think it would be helpful, first of all, for when I start describing some of these programs, to first become acquainted, a little bit more acquainted with what the New Age movement is. Because many times when we object to these programs, we began to travel around the state, meeting with various school boards as we uncovered these things. They said, well, this isn't New Age. This is not New Age stuff. And it was a simple way to get to the bottom of that. Ask them the question, can you tell me what New Age is? And they said, well, no, but I can't. This is not New Age. I'm serious. That was a pretty common thing, you know. So it is important that for discernment case, because these things come cleverly packaged sometimes, and sometimes intentionally packaged deceptively. And we document that, too, from the writings of some of these curriculum writers themselves. Let me just give you a quick overview of the New Age movement. Someone told me one time that defining the New Age movement is like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It's a difficult thing. because there's so many different variations of expression. But I'll kind of reduce it down to some of the lowest common denominators for your be helpful. And it's good to contrast it with something. Again, contrast it with the truth as a reference point. We believe, the Bible teaches, that there's a personal creator God, the triune God, who stands apart from creation, and eternally so. And the counsel of his will, Ephesians 1:11 said, God works all things after the counsel of his will. The counsel of his will, which kind of is an allusion to the Trinity there, a plurality anyway, of the Godhead, the counsel of his will, he determined to create the material and the immaterial universe. Material, of course, is the physical universe, and the immaterial, which would be the spiritual realm, angels, etc. And we do know that he rules over and defines all of reality. He defines his creation, stands above his creation. He is transcendent. He is out there ruling over his creation. He's distinct from his creation. Yet, we also know that God reveals in the Scripture that in him we have our being, in him we move and exist. He's also omnipresent. He's within his creation. He's immanent. He's transcendent and immanent. He's within his creation. Now, here's an important distinction here. Because he's immanent doesn't mean he is the creation. He's still distinct. He is upholding all things by the word of his power. He's acting upon all things. He's restraining evil. He's acting upon non-Christians. As a believer, you have a wonderful relationship, a unique relationship that he's actually residing in you in that relationship as you're born again. Now, we do know that God gave man an agency, and he chose to rebel against God. Against that creator who determines all things about how man is designed to live. He resisted that and believed the lie and began to worship and serve the creation rather than the creator. Looked to the creation to meet his needs. And there was a separation, ethical and metaphysical separation from God, and God also cursed the earth to match man's condition. We also know that God entered in his redemptive love, he entered back into the creation in a very special, unique way in the person of Jesus Christ, in God-man Jesus Christ, and redeemed the world to himself. And he is the already but not yet. You know, there's going to be the earth groans for its redemption, moans for its redemption, and we look forward to the full redemption where sin and everything and Satan are removed. From the new heavens and new earth. But in the meantime, there's this process. Well, the New Ager says no. This idea, this dualistic kind of a concept is wrong. There's only, the truth is, we've got to do away with this kind of concept because this is causing all the problems. Separation, this idea of separation creates an attitude of competition. And that's been all the problem in the world. Look at the idea of separation between sexes, the competition between males and females. Look at the parent-child relationship, this idea of separation, distinctiveness between these two. It's caused competition, rebellion takes place between races, between sociological and capitalistic and Marxism and communism and socialism and all these ideological separations and distinctions. That's caused all the problems. Hey, I'm making a pretty good case, aren't I? And so, well, you know, as Christians we say, yeah, those kinds of distinctions are sin, but we say your solution is not the right solution. Just because you pointed out areas of sin doesn't mean that's inherently evil or wrong. To have a distinction between males and females' role and those types of things. But the New Agers say, no, we have to replace that concept with this therapeutic idea that's going to change everything in the world and bring harmony and peace, and that is that the realization that there's only a oneness of all things. And this is the term monism, a one reality, no distinctions. And pantheism, because most people have this idea of God because they can't understand this mystery that's above them, beyond them, this transcendentness. They can't understand that, so we invent this idea of God. So we'll call this God to make it more palatable and identifiable to people. So we get the term pantheism. All is God and God is all. Well, now it's important to understand the process. The evolutionist view says that, the materialist view says that, hey, I recognize that there's a finiteness because my empirical data demonstrates finiteness, and I can't possibly know my finiteness anything other than that which science defines, and that's what the reality is. Therefore, I can't know anything. And the Christian says to that agnostic or atheist, and if you were here at Norman Geisler, you helped him distinguish between atheists, whether you can know everything or do know everything, and try to move him to the position of being an agnostic. What kind of an agnostic are you? That's a good apologetic approach. But with the Christian would say to the agnostic, well, I agree partly with you. I halfway agree with you. What's that? I agree that man is finite, that true science does demonstrate the boundaries, the habitation, the limits and habitations, as the Scripture says, that there are real, as true science, it does show the finiteness of things and the law, the natural law and order of things that God has created. But if there is an infinite God that we can't finitely understand, if he's infinite, then logically, what's to prevent him from being able to reveal himself to us in ways we can understand? And we believe he's done that. And again, through the Scriptures, the apostles, the prophets, and then the New Testament, the apostles, and then very strongly, of course, and dramatically in Jesus Christ in the Incarnation. And this is, again, what we would say. Now, the New Age says, no. That's not the answer. This, you've got to do away with that thinking. So Christianity clearly becomes the enemy of the New Age philosophy. This is the only true reality. And various groups call it different terminologies. God, God conscious, Christ conscious, higher self, cosmic consciousness, the universal I am. Various groups call it this with this nomenclature. And you have to realize that you're down here with a perception of finiteness, mainly given to you by these stupid Christians, you know, who've given you this idea of finiteness and separateness. You've been given that illusion. This is called this finiteness is Hindu term maya, means an illusion of finiteness. This is your true reality, and through our teachings, our gurus, or our special group, whichever, and what gives most of these New Age groups their distinctiveness is the terms they use and some of the techniques they use, but basically they're saying the same thing, most of them. And that is that if you'll partake of various psycho-spiritual techniques, technologies, will help you transcend this illusion and move up through reincarnations, gradually move up to realize, to reach a state of enlightenment here, and to realize your omniscience, omnipotence, etc. Now, does this sound familiar? How old is the New Age movement? It's very old. Genesis chapter 3. All the components of this lie are right there. God, Satan comes to man and questions God, relationship of the sufficiency of your relationship to God. He says, did God say, getting God holding out on you? Isn't that deficient? Isn't that cruel? Can't you question that authority, that sovereign authority in your life? He says, did God say you can't eat from any tree? And Eve says, no. He said, we can eat from any tree except for the one of the knowledge of good and evil in the middle of the garden. He said, we can't eat it or touch it, at least we die. Satan comes up with this first lie, you shall not die. You shall not die. Reincarnation, the substitute for the angst that all men have, that we are terminal, we know we're going to die. The cross has the solution to that. Oh, grave and death, where's your victory and where's your sting? But here's a substitute. Here's the counterfeit. There is no death. Don't worry about that anymore. There is no death. It's just cycles of rebirth. Then he says, God knows the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be open. Eat of what? the tree of knowledge of good and evil, knowledge, this is where we get the term Gnosticism, of Gnosis, if you can take of this secret hidden wisdom, you, then you can have your eyes opened, enlightenment, and you will be what? As God. No distinction between creator and creature. And this is, again, this is the same lie that we get that's generated at that point. Now, understanding that basis, we'll come back to that in a second. Look at your handout. And this is, again, a quick reminder that there are many issues that are problematic that Christians have some serious concern about in education, in public educational strategies. I mentioned them as some of the outcome-based education things, some of the globalism teachings, various clarification components, many components of the Goals 2000. The revisionism has taken place and about history, the postmodern use of language, the dogma of materialistic, that should be naturalistic, I didn't proofread it, naturalistic materialism or evolution taught in public schools. The philosophy of naturalistic materialism, which is evolution, and the implications taught in public of that taught in public schools. But I'm going to be talking about this one particular area because this is an area that we have had significant and tremendous success in challenging this issue in the public schools. That takes Christians who are informed, who begin to gather other, to organize, educate. It's kind of a cycle. Educate, organize, till your group gets bigger and bigger, and then you begin to develop a strategy to address this issue on the local level. Even what we did in Alabama is we addressed it eventually on the state level and got a law passed in Alabama, the first state I know of that got a law passed to prohibit this stuff in the public schools. So, and it can be done. And a lot of local school districts have done it. There was a regulation passed in Colorado years ago. Ironically, it was spearheaded by a Scientologist to prevent the use of psychological techniques in the public schools, some of the psychological techniques, because against their anti-psychology, anti-psychiatry, as part of their agenda too. But this is it's a winnable battle, like I said. But going on, this is the summary of the issues. Number one, the New Age movement is a spiritual and sociological phenomenon in our country. Its beliefs and practices are establishing themselves in many areas of our culture. Two, it can be demonstrated that there are many educators and curriculum developers who are either personally involved in the New Age perspective, their worldview, and as Christians, they're trying to incorporate their philosophy into the life of the community. I mean, can't blame them if that's what they believe. People have accepted, these curriculum writers and teachers have accepted the practice and techniques without knowledge of their source. We found both to be the case when we began to get into this. Some people knew what they were doing. Some people intentionally were doing it, and other people's just, I mean, we found Christian teachers. My wife, you know, got her master's degree in gifted education, and she taught gifted kids for several years in the junior high school. And she told me, she said, gosh, I was using some of these techniques. I didn't realize that they were bad. And we've met several teachers in the process, this process, that Christians who were involved in this. Three, it can be demonstrated that the adoption of New Age occult ideology and practices is just not sporadic and random, but there's an underlying philosophical current in place. And that's important to understand. It's one thing to have something just kind of pop up incidentally, but if we found that there was a clear trend that generated more and more curriculum and strategies in this area, ready to produce a flood of curriculum in public schools across America. Four, it's been in our experience that these beliefs tend to enter through counseling, self-esteem, stress reduction, health and gifted programs. You can imagine the health programs, what does that come out as? Stress reduction. And see, in the health curriculum. We found it even in creative writing courses because it got you into the right side of your brain. These techniques supposedly enhanced your intuitiveness and your creative abilities. And again, the trouble is they'll take some truth and they'll twist it. They'll use some faulty understanding of hemispheric brain studies and make it, try to twist it to fit and promote, legitimize their agenda. Number five, the usual form these programs take is deep breathing relaxation, or sometimes called progressive relaxation exercises, sometimes called guided imagery and visualization. They are sometimes associated with inappropriate, ineffective, value-free, values clarification, or affective. That means, again, done with the emotions, feeling-oriented learning programs. The techniques and presuppositions in which these programs, number six, are based upon are intrinsic to Eastern and other mystical religious traditions and practices, such as Hinduism and meditation. Further, they are frequently synonymous with the techniques of hypnosis and trance induction. Unfortunately, often these techniques are purposely disguised to project a secular appearance. Let me give you just a typical example we would have to use sometimes in communicating or getting this point across to educators, superintendents of schools, and various people we had to encounter with this. They would simply say, well, these are just simple relaxation techniques. And we would say, well, now, we're not talking about simple relaxation techniques. We're talking about hypnosis / meditation techniques. And there's a difference, a matter of degree. And also, it's a very difficult, somewhat difficult area, because people have different degrees of susceptibility to trance induction states. There are different degrees of suggestibility among people. About 25% of the population are highly suggestible. I believe that if I slow down my cadence and talked in a very methodical way, some of y'all, I could lead some of y'all into a trance state. Now, there, he had one just almost ripped off right here. Of course, at this time after lunch in a hot room is not going to hurt either. But and sleep is a trance, is an altered state of consciousness. But I'm not talking about that. But I would say this, something like this. Well, let me ask you. Suppose I was a new school teacher, and I said, okay, class, I'm your new teacher. I've got this technique that we're going to use today. As a matter of fact, we're going to use it every day to enhance your learning and your learning abilities and your retention and your performance on tests. Now, I want everybody to do this. I want everybody to put their hands together. I want you to bow your head and close your eyes. And I want you to communicate outside yourself and ask for wisdom and for help today during your studies. Now, how many times could I do that before the ACLU would probably be jumping in there and saying, whoa, you can't do that. You're doing what? Praying. Did I use the word prayer? Did I use the word God? But what did I do? I used the common techniques that are associated, that are identical, that are synonymous with prayer. And the techniques of that these people are using, we were able to well document, out of religious books and even in hypnosis books, medical textbooks. We went to the medical schools, got the textbooks right off the shelves and said, show me. Matter of fact, we kind of tricked them half the time. I had a list of about 20 excerpts in context. I said, I want you to pick out which one of these is the curriculum and which one is a hypnosis book. Pick out which one's which. They couldn't do it, of course. It was synonymous. That's the kind of thing that's helpful to be able to do. Now, going on, number, where were we, seven? Religious practice, where were we, six or seven? Seven. Religious practice in the school constitutes a violation of the Establishment Clause, should be capitalized, and the First Amendment, since public schools cannot promote the practice or ideology of a religion. Now, it's okay to teach a course on religions as long as you're supposed to give equal treatment to none of them, but it's objective information about religions. You can still do that in the schools. But this is not. This is involving them in the practice, the ideology and practice of religion. Number eight, even if administrators refuse to acknowledge this connection to occult religion, there is the further problem of using hypnosis and dissociative techniques or other psychotherapeutic methods. Using psychological techniques without informed consent of parents constitutes a violation of the Hatch Amendment and, more recently, the Grassley Act, and that is, therefore, illegal. Now, those things we've documented in the book and pointed them, gave you the reference and everything, but it's and we've quoted them. But basically, it was as a result of a number back in 1984, I think it was. There was another outcry of some of these things in the public schools and congressional hearings, which resulted in the Hatch Act, which was basically saying that the educational establishment cannot get involved in psychological testing, invasive questioning, etc., without the parents' informed written consent, kind of a thing, if it's a federally funded school program. And so the Grassley Act, actually, that was never really utilized very much, and the educators never paid attention to it because it was too vaguely written. Charles Grassley came back, and he made the act much stronger, much tighter, much more parental-friendly. And so this is very useful, thing to use on this area. Number nine, it can be established that there are genuine risk and liabilities for both children, school, and children if unlicensed teachers are involved in ministering speculative or unproven therapeutic techniques that result and resulting psychiatric problems occur. This may be considered malpractice. In other words, I'm throwing out a laundry list of problems for them. If they don't like this one, they've got to deal with this one. And pretty soon it becomes just insurmountable, the weight of all the evidence and the problems that are attached to it. Going on, I didn't add, let's see, I don't think I added, you just might want to add to that handwrite under number nine. Also, these programs have no scientific support that they work. So it's a waste of taxpayers' money. That's another thing we hit them with. They show us, show me some research that demonstrate the efficacy of these approaches to education. Now, we're still asking for it. But we were able to produce study after study in peer-reviewed, replicated studies in secular journals, scientific journals, that these don't work, that they actually, in many cases, especially this values-free, non-directive psychotherapy and drug and sex education courses, actually increased the objectionable behavior because of its approach. And we were able to demonstrate that. You like the DARE program? I mean, do you have DARE program here? I mean, DARE program, every study that I've ever read on DARE, even the government's own, the Justice Department's own study, the Triangle Institute in North Carolina, said no. It actually, there's an increase in gateway drug experimentation. Marijuana, cocaine, some of those gateway type drugs. So here we have really problems, and they can be really challenged if you get your ducks in a row. Number 10, many self-esteem oriented drug or alcohol prevention and sex education curricula utilize a non-directive decision-making model without empirical justification. That's what I'm talking about. In fact, evidence suggests these methods have actually produced a rise in these activities. Number 11, the content of many of these materials is likely a violation of the students' and parental constitutional rights to privacy. And that's also, we spell those out very thoroughly in the book as well. We go through the law, citations of the law, and the description of the decisions of the courts in these areas. Parents should not only be well-informed, but also closely involved in their parents, in their children and teachers, to make sure that such practices are not occurring in the classroom. That's a message we have for the Christian community, any community. Don't abdicate responsibility to the schools for education. Now, let me have a pause here for a second, too. You know, people ask me all the time, because you can imagine the Christian community, you get advocates of certain positions. We get homeschoolers come and say, yeah, preach on, brother. We've been trying to tell you, tell everybody that. Get them in there. Christian schools. Get them in Christian school. That's the only solution. You get people from my theological perspective, the Reformed tradition, saying, wait a minute. Don't abdicate. Don't retreat into our holy huddles. Get out there and redemptively engage the culture like we're supposed to, and get Christian school teachers and Christians involved. Truth is, you have 90% of Christians are still have their kids in public schools. So you're just going to just throw that, abandon all that? My answer to that is, I'm not going to come and say anyone is right in that area. I think that they all have merits to them. And each individual case has a different situation. Certain public schools are jungles. Other public schools have a lot of good value to them, a lot of Christian influences and school boards and Christian ministries in them. But some of them are jungles, and you just don't want to send your kid as a missionary in there when he's 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. And you know, it depends on the situation. Homeschoolers, look at the results. Homeschoolers. Results tests are much higher than national average. Christian schools, much higher than national average. But a Christian school is not the end-all answer to everything either. Well, there's a lot of hypocrisy that takes place in Christian schools too. But there are some good. You know, we have to determine what the alternatives are out there and our best course. Going on, parents, number 13. Because of the frequency of incidents, we are recommending that state or local school boards adopt official policy prohibiting techniques. This would prevent the costly political, emotional, educational, and financial consequences of litigation. Now, you might say, well, you're trying to blackmail them. Well, no, I'm just telling them what the truth is, because we've experienced it. Because if they don't respond like they should respond, then one of our next steps is to go to the media. Media loves these things. And this is a problem for the educators, because they're working on PR a lot, you know, and parental. What always gets me is when they ask for parental involvement. When schools say, we want parental involvement, not all schools, but I'm just saying many of them. What do they mean by that? They want you to sell cookies and donuts at the bazaar. They don't want you to get involved with really what's going on in the classroom, because they're the professionals, you know. And again, I'm not saying, my wife was a school teacher, and school teachers, many of them are very good, very professional. Doesn't mean that they know what they're talking about in every area, and some of them are seduced by this themselves. Another point that I was be able to kind of give you the genesis and exodus of our involvement in this, in my studies of the New Age movement, I read Marilyn Ferguson's book, The Aquarian Conspiracy. Well-respected New Age leader, she did her own study, research into how many of her colleagues in the New Age movement, what inroads, successes they've had is in permeating the New Age philosophy in our culture. She interviewed a cross section of people from various areas of disciplines, and she said this in her book. You can only have a new society, the visionaries have said, if you change the education of the younger generation. Target. Of the Aquarian Conspiracy surveyed, more involved in education than any other single category of work. They were teachers, administrators, policymakers, educational psychologists. She writes this. Deliberate use of consciousness-expanding techniques in education, only recently well underway, is new in mass schooling. This was 1980. Altered states of consciousness are taken seriously. Centering exercises, meditation, relaxation, and fantasy are used to keep the intuitive pathways open. These are techniques to encourage this awareness. Deep breathing, relaxation, yoga, movement, and biofeedback. She writes this, subtle forces are at work, factors you're not likely to see in the banner headlines. For example, tens of thousands of classroom teachers, educational consultants, and psychologists, counselors, administrators, researchers, faculty members of colleges, education have been among the millions engaged in personal transformation. In other words, personal conversion to the New Age movement. They have only recently begun to link regionally and nationally to share strategies and to conspire for the teaching of all that they most value. Now, of course, EM&R is a attempt to link regionally and nationally to bring the truth into our culture too. Well, they're doing the same thing. They have been doing. She writes this: only a new perspective can generate a new curriculum. Now, this is the crux. This is one of the crux of the issues here. What new perspective is she talking about? This is the transpersonal education. Because looking to the educational psychology, Carl Rogers and Maslow have been interpreted, at least, to be the forerunners of something called fourth force psychology, which is the idea of transcendent. It's not just self-actualization, it's self-transcendence. Rogers, we've been able to document Rogers' writings that he very much was flirting with the New Age philosophy himself. A radical center for educational philosophy, the perspective typical of the Aquarian conspiracy, is a constellation of techniques and concepts sometimes called transpersonal education. The name derives from a branch of psychology, transpersonal psychology, that focuses on the transcendent capabilities of human beings. So they've got to devise techniques that tap into these transcendent, all-powerfulness, all-wisdomness, all-knowingness of human beings. Does the name Jack Canfield sound familiar to anybody? Anybody ever read anything by Chicken Soup? Jack Canfield and Mark Victor Hansen are the editors, authors of that series of books. Jack Canfield is a major New Age leader in education. And if you read through Chicken Soup for the Soul, Chicken Soup series, I have documented and written many articles in that book, and most of these books have between 20 and 40 New Age attributions or authors or stories sprinkled all through this, through their series. But in a growing number of classrooms throughout the world, education is beginning to move in a new dimension. More and more teachers are exposing children to ways of contacting their inner wisdom and higher selves. You see the New Age philosophy. Ways of contacting their omniscience, their God self, their autonomous truth. Again, that's how the postmodern culture really feeds this. It's a greenhouse for this stuff to grow in. An influx of spiritual teachings from the East combined with a new psychological perspective in the West, transpersonal psychology, has resulted in a fresh look at the learning process, the distinction between knowledge and wisdom, the student-teacher relationship. There should be a mutual, arm-in-arm together relationship, no superior teacher-student relation, no authority, and the purpose of life. Now, I would say this is pretty religious. You're talking about the purpose of life. People everywhere are looking for a new vision, a new approach, a new paradigm for life. This stuff's been percolating, again, significantly since the late 60s. Michael McCarty? This quote is also very helpful by Jack Canfield, another article he's written. Guided imagery is a very powerful psychological tool in which can be used to achieve a wide variety of educational objectives, enhance self-esteem, expand awareness, facilitate psychological growth and integration, evoke inner wisdom, to increase empathy, expand creativity, increase memory, facilitate optimal performance, evoke a more positive attitude, and accelerate the learning of subject matter. I mean, who wouldn't want any of those things? The trouble is, it doesn't work. It doesn't do those things in any significant degree. And the trouble is, this is the propaganda. This is how they begin to sell this stuff. For instance, when they determine, many school districts around the country have, the school boards have a policy, a mandated policy for the schools to incorporate self-esteem training in the schools. Did y'all realize that? Check and see your school district, see if it's mandated some type of self-esteem curriculum. Well, they don't teach, until recently, have not taught self-esteem. What does that mean? How do you teach self-esteem? Where do you go? Do you get that in college classes? Do the school teachers, do they get that? So what do? They go to workshops, and they go to their curriculum labs to find prepackaged programs and make all these promises that this is what it'll do. And that's how they, a lot of times, will adopt these kinds of programs. Well, the trouble is, there's been some helpful backlash. Well, here's another quote. It's important. Dick Sefton is a very hostile, it's a New Age leader who's very hostile to Christianity, writes this: one of the biggest advantages we have as New Agers is once the occult, metaphysical, and New Age terminology is removed, we have concepts and techniques that are very acceptable to the general public. So we can demonstrate the names and demonstrate the change the names and demonstrate the power. In so doing, we can open the door to millions who normally would not be receptive. We were able to get many, many quotes from these curriculum writers, well-known curriculum writers, well-respected, where they were very clearly saying, change the terminology to resist parental backlash. Change the terms. Trouble is, the proof wasn't in the pudding, and people who were looking for results weren't seeing it, and we began to see this kind of a backlash from stories like this, the curse of self-esteem, what's wrong with the feel-good movement? Scenes like this dramatically brought these here in Colorado. In other places, this was actually the eighth in a series of incidents, major incidents. Got the most publicity, though, in Columbine High School. And everybody's asking. That's the question. Look at what they're asking on the fronts of these news. That's U.S. News. There's Newsweek. There's the question. Why? Why? Now, it's not just some simplistic answer. It's a complicated answer. But there have been stories. For instance, in the new edition of the book, call this to your attention. Information that has been helpful has recently surfaced in July 13, 1998 issue of Newsweek, in an article focusing on how very recent studies of the effectiveness of, quote, self-esteem programs are actually backfiring and are potentially dangerous. The article refers to one of the recent school murderers, Luke Woodham, in Pearl, Mississippi, who, quote, fits the profile of the dangerous personalities that these programs can foster. And many comments made by the president of the American Psychological Association commenting about how those direct, very, very probable link between the self-esteem programs and this issue of narcissism, and the delusions of grandeur and things that some of these kids have gotten. And again, their autonomy, their personal autonomy, that they make all the rules, and they're the ones who determine what's true and what's not true and what's valuable and what's not valuable within themselves. Let me show you an example of some of these programs. This was a guidance counseling curriculum called Flights of Fantasy. No, was it Flights of Fantasy? I can't remember the name of it now. But anyway, this is, it talked about a flight plan. It was geared for young kids, you know, for elementary age kids. And it, first of all, the first part of the study taught them how to go on a flight. And it said, okay, kids, I want everybody to put their heads down on the desk and close your eyes. We'll cut the lights off and play this soft music in the background. And I want you to listen carefully. I want you to get ready to take off on your flight today. I want you to do the countdown with me, slowly. 10, 9, 8. They take you down all the way down to 1. You get about 5 and they say, you're getting very relaxed now, ready for your flight. And I'm telling you, these are standard induction techniques of meditation / hypnosis. The idea, again, is to block out all distractions into it's an ultra-high focus where you then go into an altered trance state, and you're highly suggestible. And it depends on the ethicalness of the person that's guiding you through the imagery as to what happens here. Because you remember that, you heard those old comments that a person under hypnosis is not going to do what he normally wouldn't do? That's hogwash. How many times have you seen these stage hypnotists make people jump around like a chicken or something on the stage? You think they're going to risk that kind of embarrassment? The trouble is you can't distinguish between fantasy and reality in that kind of a state. The lines are blurred. And, you know, you can be made to feel like you're freezing. You can actually have that physiological change under hypnosis or a meditation because, again, of the suggestiveness. But going on, wouldn't it be great if we could get answers? This is after you're in the state, now the guided imagery is taking place. Wouldn't it be great if we could get answers to any questions we wanted to ask? Sometimes we can find answers by looking in the encyclopedia. Other times there are no ready-made answers for our questions. When we can't find an answer, don't know what to do about something, we have a problem. When this happens, it's a good idea to talk to someone about it. Well, okay, that's not bad so far. But who do they direct you to talk to? And this, there are some people that are very wise. They know a lot of things. If we could find a wise person to talk to, we might be able to get answers to our questions. A wise person could tell us about the, and I thought it was interesting, at least in the written part, they put right things in quotation marks. What's the implication there? That there is relative. There's nothing that's really absolutely right. The right things that we should do. This is kind of a subtle thing. Today, as you travel in space, you will meet a wise person. You'll be able to talk to them and ask them questions. Your questions may be about what am I able to do. We had situations where kids were led to meet a white rabbit in a field, and this white rabbit was omniscient, could telepathically communicate, and you could ask the white rabbit any question you wanted to ask, and then he would give you the answer to your question. Questions about identity and who you are and what is life all about and what am I going to do in this situation. And I remember going to one of the directors of curriculum at one of the public schools, pretty sophisticated, Huntsville, Alabama, which is the rocket capital. I mean, that's where all the aerospace scientists and people live. And so it's a high level of educational level there. And so I went to the curriculum head of that particular school district, coordinator, and posed this problem to him. And they said, no, Craig, we're not teaching these kids Hinduism and Buddhism and stuff, and we're just helping the child get in touch with their higher selves. I said, what higher self are you talking about? Don't you realize that you're basing these kinds of statements on some type of presuppositions? And what do you mean higher self? And do you not understand this is a basic view of defining reality of the New Age movement? And these are the techniques that are used. They're intrinsic to that. Anyway, it was interesting. Matter of fact, they said that they were going to table that particular study. Table that particular study. Let's see if I have that story here real quick. Yeah. They're going to table that particular study, and we heard, and they're going to look at it and get back with us and make some decision. It was one audio tape and one 25-page pamphlet, a little booklet, was the curriculum. A year later, We hadn't heard from them. But then we started hearing from parents who said, that program is starting back up again. And there's two more that are similar to it. We go back up there, they would not meet with us. Stonewall. So, okay. Call the newspaper reporter. We're having a meeting, parental meeting, in the school. There's a law that if they let the other organizations use the facilities, you have to let anybody use it. So we utilized that, and we got into the school, and the press came. As the day of the meeting, which was going to be that evening, the schools sent a notice to the paper. And so the pressure, that's what I'm talking about, the PR, they're very sensitive to this. And so you have to, be a wise as a serpent and harmless as a dove in some of these issues and appeal to those things. This is a course that was in the a program called, a book called Becoming a Master Student. Becoming a Master Student that we found that was in four junior colleges and three universities in Alabama, required for all freshman students because they said that there was a dropout rate of about 50% of incoming freshmen. I never realized it was that high. But they were trying to reverse that by going through this program, becoming a creative student. And it was written by an Estian, the forum, landmark forum guy. In the beginning of the book, he gave acknowledgments to Werner Erhard and all these people, and I went through here, and you would not believe some of the stuff. Maybe you would, some of the stuff that we saw in the program. But every fifth or sixth page was an exercise of meditation. Again, teaching the schools, teaching the kids the way you get better, enhance your creativity and your wisdom and your ability to do things is through meditation. Another situation is a game, a fantasy game called Vampire. And interesting, I got called by a lady, a Catholic lady, an attorney in New York, in White Plains, Pound Ridge, just above New York City, the Connecticut border, And she said, they've been having all kinds of horrible programs in our schools. And we're trying to get a bunch of people. I've heard about it. I got your book somehow, and I read about it. And I think you may be one of the people that can help. And we kind of consulted, and she flew in William Colson and various others, a Catholic priest and a Lutheran a bishop and cross-denominational people. And we got a guy named, I can't think of his name now. Anyway, a psychologist, a Christian psychologist. He was a school psychologist who had written a lot of stuff on this issue. We got a big panel up there. This is the kind of stuff they had in the school curriculum. Well, that actually wasn't Vampire. It was Magic the Gathering. Magic the Gathering, another fantasy card game. They were using Magic the Gathering as part of their math curriculum. They were also making models to Aztec gods. They were engaged in earth worship, to worshiping a Hindu god, led them through exercises of yoga, and they had a psychic come in. They had crystals, a person instructing how to use crystals, and witchcraft dolls, worry dolls, to instruct them in worry dolls how to use those things in the public school curriculum. Well, we had this meeting up there in the public school auditorium again, and there was a big turnout because it became quite controversial at this point. Pound Ridge is where Richard Gere has his Buddhist school, his camp there. Before the meeting, we were driving around, the parents said, take a look at the street signs we have here. And they were really interesting. They were wood, carved wood, the street signs, and it looked like the fingers were pointing like this. So-and-so street with the finger pointing like it's going down that way. I said, well, that's kind of neat. She says, no, look a little closer. And it wasn't that. It was What's the satanic symbol? Satanic sign? Is it like this or like this? I think it's like this. Yeah, it's not. This is love, I think, and this, but it was like this. Now, why would a street sign have that pinky finger sticking out rather than this? And it turns out this town is full. It was almost like Frank Peretti novel. The town was full. I'm serious. It was full. I have never, during that meeting, and I've been up against some hostile Scientologists before, but this group, I have never encountered so much demonic and real hostility from the people, that the school teachers that were there and the kids. One was they said was a known witch and had his own little coven there of kids, and they were sitting there mocking and throwing out all kinds of sarcastic comments and stuff during our presentation. By the way, the Catholic ladies finally had to sue, and they sued the school board. I don't know if y'all read about it in the paper, but they did win 3 of the 11 points, and it put the school board on real notice on this issue. So these are the kinds of things that are out there. We're, unfortunately, it's again the same type of thing. I've got a two-hour presentation down to an hour in 10 minutes or so. But let me encourage you to take this issue seriously. It is a winnable battle, but you have to come informed. I encourage you to get our book and to follow. We've got a section in here, how to overcome objectives, which we have here in your notes. We have another section on what parents can do, specific things that are, again, tried and proven. Everything is well documented. And when you start the process, all you got to do is go to a good library, and you can get copies of these things, hard copies of things we've documented here, to make up your packet. I met with the state school board members one-on-one, and we got a coalition of people. We got the Rutherford Institute, we got Focus on the Families organization, American Family, Donald Wilder's group, their extensions. We got various coalitions of people to team up, make it a team effort here. We had 2 full days of hearings at the state school board. The press was there, ACLU was there, and People for the American Way came to represent, to speak for the students, which tells you, again, where their philosophy is. And so we had school teachers who are Christians. We had psychologists. We had attorneys. We had parents. We had children all testifying. And I had personally presented each school board member with 800 pages of documentation. And again, I knew he wouldn't read them all, so I put the most important ones on top with a highlight. That you need to do that too, so they'll look at the highlight stuff and read that quickly. And we had a vote, and it was a lot of pressure from the media there, and a lot of exposure there, and they passed the regulation. That's why I said it was a miracle. As a matter of fact, if you understand how the process went, you'd know it was a miracle, because one of the educator Board of Education guys got confused about his vote, so he claims, because he was a real liberal and a real leader in that area, kind of proponent, protector of the teachers, but he voted on our side. So I was saying, well, you know, God sometimes, you know, puts a veil over their eyes. But anyway, that was a real wonderful experience. And again, we had successes in school districts individually. We ran up against some real stonewall and resistance in other school districts. That's why we decided to go ahead and go to the state school board. Now, you can file a lawsuit. That's another way to go about it. Some parents have done that, like the lady in New York's and up in White Plains. Or you can go through legislature. We figured it was better to try to change 10 people's minds on the state school board than trying to change 70 or 80 people's or 100 people's minds in the legislature. But interestingly, in Alabama, if a regulation is passed, it then goes through the state school board, it then goes to the legislative committee in the Congress and the legislature, and they decide on it and act on it, and it becomes actually a law. So we actually went through the back door and got a law made out of that whole process. So that's another thing to keep in mind. I'll stick around here for any questions. Again, I'm sorry we ran over time, but I'll just stick around for questions, and we'll conclude. Thank you.
I do have a quick
Yeah, sure.
Have you had any schools have a problem with Halloween and Halloween parties?